Hey guys, Dr. Smith here. This is the lecture on Chinese political arrangements and institutions for comparative politics of East Asia at the University of Virginia's College at Wise. So I hope you're all safe and healthy and happy. And I think this is our last major lecture for this class. So let's get to it, shall we? All right. Oh, wow. Talking about the design of the Chinese political system is a bit complicated. It's a very protean system, first off, which is to say that in my lifetime, you know, I was born in the 70s, it has changed repeatedly, sometimes pretty major changes, like the changes instituted by Deng Xiaoping after he became the preeminent leader and kind of pushed out the Maoists with his cadre. But also the changes that followed Deng Xiaoping leaving office and the emergence of steadily more and more regularized and institutionalized politics. And then recently the efforts by President Xi to try and reinstitute a more, I don't know what the right word for it, more authoritative, less institutionalized system, with him in a more definitive position of control than he would have been under the kind of traditional post-Deng model. So it's complicated in no small part because it just keeps changing. It's also complicated because this is an authoritarian state. This isn't a democracy. Rule of law is at best problematic when it's working. Institutions are often malformed, corruption is very high, secrecy in terms of how things actually get done, that is to say the actual structure of power, is oftentimes significantly different than the process by which law dictates, the institutions dictate it should be done. There's a lot of moving parts when trying to keep up with analyzing Chinese politics. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to try and give you a very basic introduction, to these institutions as they exist in the current period, that is to say, the early 2020s period. And be very careful about assuming that these institutions and structures remain in the form that they are today for any particular length of time. If you end up eventually teaching or lecturing or creating policy based on this, it's always worth going to the books and checking out the most recent literature to make sure that there haven't been fairly meaningful changes to the arrangement of things. So whenever possible, I'm going to try and talk about things that tend to stay regularized, particularly regularized in the Dengist and post-Dengist period, and try and make clear what is more stable versus what isn't. So the first thing that we have to know, that we have to bear in mind before we get into the actual institutions of the state, is that, frankly, because we have a one-party state system in China, we can think of it as having a state and maybe a meta-state or a para-state that functions simultaneously and in coordination with the actual formal state. And that is the party, the Chinese Communist Party, the CCP, as I'll sometimes call it. Also, in some literature, you'll see it written as the CPC, the Communist Party of China. Technically, these are both totally appropriate acronyms. It just depends on how you translate the words from Chinese. So, the Chinese Communist Party has, what you need to visualize is, for every institution of the state that we talk about, there is an analogous institution of, or set of institutions in the Chinese Communist Party. The Chinese Communist Party is not the only political party in China, but it's the only one that really, frankly, matters. There are what are called like the democratic parties, which are allowed, that have been basically approved as acceptable and adequately patriotic and not so... They basically are regarded as not presenting a meaningful threat to the regime or to the policies of the regime. But in practice, what really matters is the Chinese Communist Party. So we for every time we talk about an institution of the state, we're also going to go and we're going to talk about its parallel para-institution or para-regime or whatever. There's a million ways you could say it. Use whatever you think is appropriate in the political party that is the Chinese Communist Party. So generically speaking, let's kind of outline the design of the state first, just to give you an idea. Now it should be said the Chinese tradition, and if we were going to be talking about Taiwan in this class, you'd see it's actually parallel in that, is to have more what we would kind of generically call branches than we have in the United States. In the United States, we talk about having three constitutionally mandated branches. In the Chinese system, it is somewhat more complicated. We have a legislative branch. We have an executive system that is a, we'll see, as a complex kind of mixed system. But we also see other bodies that are regarded as the equivalent of branches. Basically a military branch, and then three bodies that we can think of as having adjudicatory functions, but which are regarded in contemporary Chinese politics as effectively the equivalent of a constitutional branch in and of themselves. So the legislative branch, the core element of the legislative branch, is what we call the National People's Congress. Now, we're going to see that it's a bit misleading to say that's the core element, but we'll come to that in time. And then we have the State Council. The State Council is the core executive body in the People's Republic of China. The Central Military Commission is the core military body, for lack of a better terms. It's in charge of notably the People's Liberation Army, the People's Armed Police, and the militia of China. And then we have the three adjudicatory branches. We have the Supreme People's Court, which we'll see doesn't quite mean the same thing it means when we say Supreme Court in the instance of most countries, and the Supreme People's Procurate, which is basically a branch in charge of the prosecutorial element of the Chinese adjudication system, which is granted nearly equivalent rank to the judgeship. Now, that should give you a hint that we don't have a system that is adversarial like the United States, but a system more like the kind of Roman civil kind of system that we see emerging out of, the Napoleonic tradition and so forth in Europe, the continental European model. And then we have something called the National Supervisory Commission, which is regarded as in essence, an equivalent branch. Which is an intriguing thing. It's the newest one of the branches in the Chinese system. And that's going to be, again, it's adjudicatory, it is supervisory, and basically its whole purpose is it exists to root out corruption, which China is desperately in need of, but we'll see that this can present, as you would imagine, some institutional problems. There's also a body called the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference. Tell me that ain't a mouthful. The Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference, often just abbreviated as the CPPCC, but given how many acronyms have C and P in them in Chinese politics, I generally just say the whole thing. But luckily, we won't be talking about that too much. That is a kind of an advisory chamber or an advisory branch. Some authors argue that it is kind of comparable to an upper house in a bicameral legislature where the upper house is merely advisory. The Chinese institutions and laws themselves say it's something different. It is advisory, but it is not legislative in any proper sense by Chinese official descriptions. What have you. That works. Okay. So those are the broad kind of central bodies of the Chinese system. And you're saying, okay, that's a lot, Dr. Smith. And surely, I won't lie, it is. But let's start breaking down what they do, what they are, piece by piece. And we'll start, as I like to, generally, with the National People's Congress. Now, the National People's Congress is the legislative body, as we said. It meets 2 weeks a year. Its members often, not just may hold other offices, but very often hold other offices, whether they are offices in lower level electoral bodies or in different bureaucracies, in the military. Certainly there are many of them, if not most of them, hold body or positions in the Chinese Communist Party or one of the Democratic parties, but what have you. But so it's a unicameral legislature. Current membership, now this changes a little bit almost every single, every 5 year cycle, is 2,980 members. Let me say that again, 2,980 members. Currently, it is the largest single legislative body on earth. And it's worth looking up some pictures to take a gander at. It's truly gigantic. The building that they hold their meetings in, I've not been in it. I've been to the outside. It's an impressive thing. It's a pretty big old place. Now, these 2,980 members are allocated by population to each province-level body. We'll talk about what a province-level body is. Each province-level body is guaranteed a minimum of 15 representatives in the National People's Congress. And then after those 15, it's allocated according to relative population. Now, we're going to talk about how they get elected in a minute. The process is a bit. But we'll come to that in a second. I don't want to jump it because it will take some explanation. They serve five-year terms. And these five-year terms, they're elected. Here's the title for the system that they use that I've found most commonly associated with it. It's sometimes referred to as a multi-tier electoral system is how they're elected. Multi-tier electoral. In other words, it's not a direct electoral process at all. It is a profoundly pyramid-like structure in which there is a steady filtering based on every imaginable political measure you can, any political measure you can conceive of is filtering people out who are not regarded as politically acceptable to move up to the next level of exercising, for lack of a better term, suffrage. So, hypothetically, to be nominated for the National People's Congress is easy. You only have to have a nomination from one of the parties. Now, of course, that means the Chinese Communist Party, as you might imagine, is getting in with most of them. But the Democratic parties that are, again, legally allowed by the Chinese system, which of course means they're allowed by the Chinese Communists, are also allowed to nominate people for election. And these nominations can also be done when a citizen has the written support of 10 other citizens. So it's entirely possible that on in the initial nomination list that's handed over when we talk about what bodies elect, for it to have substantially more people on the list than are actually going to be elected. So in that sense, it may be competitive. Now, bear in mind that those lists get pared down. Some people are regarded as politically unacceptable for their political positions. They are regarded as criminal. They are regarded as this, that, and the other, and are simply removed from the list. They're just not allowed to actually stand for election, even though they've gotten nominated. Other people get nominated, but it would be kind of a bad decision to vote for them, as you might imagine. So even though there is the pretense of competition, and again, we'll get into how that competition happens, it's not particularly competitive. And you know what? Let's talk about how that composition happens. Now, the Chinese system is competition. The Chinese system is unitary, guys. It is a unitary system that makes like the tries to make the appearances of federalism, or at least some kind of lean towards federalism, but be under no illusion. All genuine, real, fundamental, definitive power lays with the national government. The provinces and other lower levels have what are called people's congresses, just like the National Congress. So we have the National People's Congress, we have provincial level people's congresses, and then we have local people's congresses. Those local people's congresses are elected in direct elections by people at the local level of analysis. Well, and we'll talk about these different levels later. Now, again, who can actually participate, who actually gets nominated? These are things that are more problematic because, again, we have a country that's pretending to be democratic, but it's not democratic. Like, if you look at the measures on the 10-point scale of zero being non-democratic, a perfectly non-democratic state, 10 being a perfectly democratic, China typically comes in at 1 or somewhat less than 1. So be under no illusion, these institutions are what we would call free and fair. But the local people's congresses then elect from their membership, basically, representatives to the provincial level congresses. And these provincial level congresses are the provinces, the autonomous regions, certain very large cities and that are either divided into districts or that actually are directly controlled by the central government. We'll talk about that in a second. Those provincial level congresses then elect the members of the National People's Congress. So what we see is that in a sense, it's not entirely alienated from the tradition of the state legislatures of the United States electing the old senators, or the senators in the old traditional way that they used to have back before the amendment of the Constitution around the beginning of the 20th century. That said, this is, given that there's no like legitimately competitive democracy in the level of the election of the state legislatures, or the, in China, provincial levels, it's very dangerous to overly stretch that principle. So basically, if you're a member of the National People's Congress, you've gone through both a vetting process at the local level and the provincial level, which then made you eligible to become a member of the National People's Congress. And you probably still continue to serve in those positions locally and provincially. It's entirely likely you're going to keep whatever political responsibilities you had before and continue to, as long as it doesn't become too overwhelming, continue to exercise them. Now, sometimes as you move up, you get other parallel, say I move from the provincial to the national level and I start accumulating offices at the national level, it may cease to be viable for me to continue to hold my provincial level or my local level position, so I may let those go by the wayside. But that's not necessarily the case. It's intriguing. So the National People's Congress, let's talk about what its formal obligations are, and we'll talk about then the real limits on those on what those powers are. Its obligations or powers are the big one. Honestly, I think this is the most important thing. Anytime there's an amendment to the Constitution or the basic laws, which of course are Constitution-level legal documents, these laws have to be passed by the National People's Congress as a whole. The National People's Congress is also technically responsible for electing a number of the kind of high-level executive positions. The president, the vice president, the premier, and members of the state council. We're going to talk about all these, don't worry. The chairman of the Central Military Commission, and the other members of the CMC, the president of the Supreme Court, or the Supreme People's Court, the president, or the procurator general, oy vey, what a word, of the Supreme Procurate. It also approves every 5 years the national plan for socioeconomic development or any amendments in that process. It approves the budget every year, and it has, technically, every member, in theory, has the right of initiation, but in practice, virtually all meaningful legislation, anything that's actually going to change how the state does business, is either going to come from the Presidium, which we'll talk about, National People's Congress Standing Committee, which we're about to talk about, the State Council, the CMC, the Central Military, the Supreme People's Court, or the Supreme People's Procurate. Holy vey, these are mouthfuls, right? So in fact, most of the legislation is really going to be coming from these very elite people in the other branches that are proposing legislation under the assumption it's already been vetted in straw polling, like informal agreements by other elites at the top level of the Chinese state. And these, and it's also, of course, because that we'll see, been vetted by the Chinese Communist Party. So a good way to think of the Chinese National People's Congress, at least the way that most scholars look at it, is that it is a body that does have all the formal characteristics of a legislature, right? But in practice, the National People's Congress is a rubber stamp institution. Its main goal is to act as a vetting process for making sure elites gradually move up to the national level, from which they may be then selected for other positions. But also, it is this confirmation of the quote-unquote people's will. It's intended to give the appearance of democracy where no democracy really exists. If you've ever heard of Francis Fukuyama and his book, The Last Man of the End of History, he talks about this quite a bit, this idea that that modern states have to justify themselves in terms of democracy, even if they're not democratic. And I think most scholars would argue in China that's exactly what's taking place, is the appearance of democracy where there is none whatsoever, in any terms that would be recognizable practically in the West, in liberal states and in democratic states. What's kind of sad about that is it looked like in the 80s and in the 90s, putting aside the Tiananmen incident of 89, it looked like there was a steady process of not just economic liberalization, but political liberalization that accompanied a process of increasing shift towards a rule of law system and increasing institutionalization. And it was very hopeful for a while that China was maybe not on the verge of a full-on like democratic revolution like we see take place in so many nations in the revolutions of, say, 89 to 92, but at least maybe a gradual easing into the bathtub of political liberalization. There were a lot of experiments, particularly at the village level, with different kinds of electoral institutions. You can look that up. There's a lot of good stuff. If we were meeting in Wise right now, I have a book I'd bring and let you borrow if any of you were particularly interested. But the truth of the matter is that in the PRC, the process of institutionalization and political liberalization has hit some hiccups. And so the conundrum is, certainly things are becoming more institutionalized and more rule of law oriented, but this has not necessarily led to what we would think of as the emergence of robust liberal political institutions. And so if that's what you were hoping for in China, that's a disappointing thing. Now, the National People's Congress, as we said, is really important in particular because it appoints, quote-unquote, a couple of these key positions. The one that probably matters the most is the NPC Standing Committee, the National People's Congress Standing Committee. That's the it's technically listed as the permanent organ of the NPC. And it is the highest formal body of state power. And it basically fulfills almost all of the role of the NPC when the NPC is not in session. Now remember, the NPC is only in session for about 2 weeks a year every spring. So the rest of the year, who's running the country? Who's issuing legislative dictions? Who's making decisions about changes to the budget? Who's holding hearings? Who's engaging in legislative oversight? It's almost all done by the standing committee of the NPC. So who's on the standing committee then, Dr. Smith, you're asking? Well, the NPC is made up of a number of people. It has a chairman and several vice chairmen at any one point. Right now, I believe it has 14 from what I read earlier. It has a secretary general who is kind of in charge of managing the affairs of the body. It also has other representatives that are elected by the NPC. Now, these other representatives are vetted both vertically and horizontally. They're vetted, and that kind of vetting process is something we see a lot. So there's a vetting both by the CCP and its leadership, its parallel leadership, which we're going to get into, but it's also vetted by the previous members of the standing committee. So the elites are engaged in a constant kind of internal recycling process in which as they retire, they choose people to, or are pushed out. As members retire or are pushed out, they are replaced by the remaining members by politically acceptable alternatives from the emergent new elite that are especially found in the NPC and other equivalent bodies. Other of the kind of national level branches, as it were. So some of these other representatives are specifically leaders in the Chinese Communist Party, representatives from the People's Liberation Army. There's always some representatives recently from the Democratic parties. Again, those second and third parties, those other parties that are considered acceptable alternatives to the CCP by the CCP. There's representatives from different people's civic organizations and different people's social and economic organizations. And there are always representatives from minorities. Now, this is something very important. The Chinese are very aware of the fact that they have many, many, many national minorities. National minorities with populations as large as many independent countries. And these national minorities They are the dominant populations over pretty significant parts of the real estate of China. And so the Chinese state makes a real effort to, at minimum, now depending on who you ask, to actually include minorities or to, and I'm inclined to lean this way, and I think most scholars do, to give the appearance of inclusion of minorities in leadership positions. So they basically maintain a guarantee that representatives of any minority group that has more than 1 million citizens will have at least one representative on the standing committee. So how many people are on the standing committee, Dr. Smith?
This is a pretty darn big committee, you're probably thinking. And the simple truth of the matter is, right now, there's about 175 committee or 75 members. 175 committees, that's a lot. 175 members. Now, obviously, that's too big to do most of the business. So it's divided into committees and subcommittees like any other legislature. But that's bigger than a lot of national legislatures. So the standing committee basically is a little different. Technically, members, if you're on the standing committee, you're not allowed to hold other administrative, judicial, or procuratorial offices. So you can hold other executive offices, but you cannot hold administrative, judicial, or procuratorial offices.
And again, they can pass legislature just like the MPC, except for questions that are constitutional or basic law. They also have the right to interpret the Constitution and laws. So the equivalent role that you might think of as constitutional oversight that we see in, say, the Supreme Court of the United States actually lies with the Standing Committee of the NPC. The right to supervise the State Council, the CMC, the Supreme Court, the Supreme Procurate, all local and subnational bodies also lies with the Standing Committee. So the Standing Committee has what we, the way you might regard this is they have a power of annulment. So not only do they have the power to interpret the Constitution and the basic laws and the regular laws, but they have the ability to annul, in essence, any decision made by anybody in the entire system. Now, let's not overstate how this is used. It's much more likely to be used in the annulment of decisions by subnational bodies. But given the fact that, again, most politics that we can say are, I don't want to say matter, most politics that are public in China are preceded by informal closed-door politics, right? And so the odds that an annulment will be necessary are fairly low because you just don't pass things that you know that are going to get annulled. And, of course, any annulment is going to require basically the pre-approval of the Chinese Communist Party and the kind of super elites. But let's not underestimate the role of this Standing Committee. The Standing Committee has 175 members who are basically the most powerful kind of elites or the bulk in numbers of the most powerful elites. It is, when I wrote about it in graduate school, I used to call it the oligarchy. It is a bunch of very, 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 very powerful people who are brought together through their mutual agreement and through some pretty fascinating personal and ideological and power politics. So other things the Standing Committee has the power to do, it has the power of appointment and removal when the NPC is not in session. It also has the power to ratify or nullify treaties, and it has the power to declare a state of war, to mobilize the masses, which may be for mobilizing the military or mobilization in a more Maoist kind of fancy way, and of course for the declaration of martial law. So it's not an insignificant formal power set that the Standing Committee has. Now, here's what you're probably going to ask yourself. How the hell does the legislative process work in this definitively unicameral, not democratic polity? Well, theoretically and officially what happens is work is the work to be done is laid out by a committee of the MPC, the Legislative Affairs Committee, which prepares basically five-year plans of what legislation we need to get done in the next 5 years. And this committee then splits up the role of drafting legislation among different legislators. And different legislators are basically told that they're responsible for having a draft done by X period of time, normally for a given kind of session of the National People's Congress. And this legislation is then sent and vetted by the Communist Party leadership and vetted by the elites, of course, of the Standing Committee, one assumes. So again, this constant ongoing discourse of vetting. And then eventually it's given to the MPC in session. And most of the time, if it's a major law, the MPC will simply rubber stamp it. They'll just vote for it, and it becomes law. Now, there
have been hints of increasing rebelliousness in the NBC, not NBC, that's a TV channel, NPC, in the sense that there are increasing efforts to reject legislation. It's not common at all. The first time it ever happened wasn't until 1986. And that was really just a revision, a demand for a revision of an element. The first outright rejection of a bill, I think it was just like a highway bill, wasn't until 2000. And since 2000, I only know of one or two other incidents, I believe, that this has happened in. So, to be frank, this is a fairly rare occurrence, that the NPC doesn't simply do what it's told. So again, anytime you can assume that a legislature will always pass the legislation given to it by other elites in the system, particularly the executive elites, it should throw up red flags about how democratic that system is, especially if we're looking at the kind of informal politics coupled with the opaque process of people gaining access to power. All of these are things that, frankly, should be raising red flags in terms of, is this a democratic system in practice? We see attributes of this in some other countries that are democratic, but are this kind of opaqueness and this kind of these problematic things are much more spotty, or it's just one problem or another. It's not like all of these sorts of systematic problems. But let's not dwell on that. So, for some reason, I'm thinking of Greece and its tendency of the legislature to pass almost anything that is given to it by the executive branch. That just kind of popped in my head. So you may remember that I mentioned another body that's kind of a state body that is regarded by some Western thinkers as a kind of a quasi upper house, but is in practice not really an upper house. It's an independent body. It has no legislative power. And that is the tongue twister Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference, which has got no formal power, but it is a consultating body that consults on virtually every imaginable political body. Literally, it exists to allow all sorts of different organizations and political actors and political parties and social and economic actors to be able to weigh in on questions of the day, basically whatever it is that the NPC is considering, and give opinions. You can think of it as it is parallel but independent. And like the NPC, which we pointed out, has independent legislatures that then at the province level, the local level, that are involved in the election process, there are parallel but independent conferences on the provincial and local levels. But these are not quite equivalent. They don't have the power to elect the members of the Chinese People's Political Consultative Council. Instead, these are chosen by different other kind of elite bodies in the PRC. And its membership tends to reflect kind of the focus and the arrangement of power that exists at that point in China. So it's the members, the organizations in it, and the members that constitute it vary over time in a way that's actually quite revealing. So it used to be, when I first started studying China in graduate school, this body was more dominated by state-owned enterprises and their representatives, and by a group that are generically kind of known as the princelings, the children and grandchildren of the old founders of the old regime, the Maoist and the Dengist period. And increasingly, these folks are displaced by other, like the new, more truly independent representatives of the truly independent industries that have emerged in China, especially in the high-tech sector. So what we see is like literally, if you want to know how they're chosen,
The only thing I can find, and I think I found this on their actual website, was that members are selected through a process called consultation and recommendation by the standing committee of the CPPCC. So they, just like the NPC, the CPPCC has a standing committee. And that standing committee basically chooses, in discussion with other elites in the system, who will be brought up and included as a member in the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference. So again, this body doesn't really exist to do anything other than consult. That doesn't mean it's irrelevant. It is regarded as a system of making sure that lots of voices are brought into discussions on issues that are particularly important. It also gives an opportunity for potential elites to get involved in the process who maybe are either not viable political candidates in another way, or who are, their power base, let's say their power base just doesn't function well in a way that would make them appropriate for ending up in the NPC or the standing or committee of the NPC or something like that. So the intriguing thing is that the plenary session of the NPC and the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference typically is the exact same time. And this period in the spring is called the two sessions. So they meet at the same time, and in meeting at the same time, that gives them the opportunity. Everybody's in Beijing, and it gives them the opportunity for a lot of, again, that informal political process, which is so essential for generating political outcomes, creating relationships. We're going to talk about those, which are really critical to the emergence of political outcomes in the Chinese system. The CPPCC has 10 special committees that are topic-oriented. I think that I mentioned that they have five-year terms, and they do not issue laws, as we said, but they do issue sometimes resolutions, statements of opinion in support or opposition or protest of different things, what have you. Okay, so this leads us into the realm of the executive branch. But before we go there, I want to talk about the parallels to the NPC and the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference. Now, to do this, to understand what those analogs are, all we have to do is look over at the institutional design of the parties. So I'm flipping through my notes to get over that. If we look at the institutional design, again, we have a hierarchical system. There's a standing committee of the Central Politburo, otherwise known as the Politburo, that has 5 to 11 members and meets, we think, probably every week. There's a Central Politburo, or again, the Politburo, that has that meets, I believe, about once a month. We have that is, in theory, what chooses the standing committee, and the Politburo itself is, in theory, chosen by the Central Committee. The Central Committee of the CCP, that is. And the Central Committee of the CCP meets every year, so it's meeting at about the same time as the NPC. Then below that, we have the National Congress of the CCP. And the National Congress meets every 5 years. So what does this really mean? What's the dance on this, guys? Well, ultimately what it means is that we have a parallel system of making sure that that policies are emerging in the Communist Party. And that the policies emerging in the Communist Party are parallel and leading and critiquing and overseeing and revising potential policies and ultimately finished policies emergent in the legislative process of the state of the People's Republic of China. Now, the National Congress of the CCP, in theory, elects the Central Committee. And that seems to be true. Most people I've read seem to agree that's kind of that's pretty much how it works. That the National People's Congress is critical in electing the Central Committee, but of course that with all the biases in terms of who can get on the ballot, and you're typically limited to a yes, no, abstain on that, on whether or not someone's going to be in. So it's a vetted list that you get to vote from. And then the Central Committee of the CCP, which can have a maximum of 205 members. Right now, from what I read, it has 171 members. That body then itself is theoretically in charge of choosing the members of the Politburo. But in practice, the Politburo, and of course the even more elite Standing Committee, seem to, in fact, renew themselves. So they're ultra powerful elites who, as members retire, choose the replacements, or if people are purged, they choose the replacements for those people. So, and again, there's no definitive number that have to be in either of those bodies. The Standing Committee typically comes in at 5 to 11. The Politburo, from what I can find, it looks like the Politburo has about 25 members right now. So they're both, in fact, I've got that written down, 25 members. So 25 members Politburo, 5 to 11 in the Standing Committee typically. And what happens is that these groups are, these are the most powerful people in China. You don't get onto the Politburo unless you have some very high position in the state, which is analogous to high position in the party. And this is the thing. Your party membership is your vetting membership. It is what gives you the access to the state system. But in practice, the two, a good way to think of it is when we, well, you know what, we'll explain this in a second really well when we talk about the president. But it, you may be, actually, let me look up, I'm going to open up a list of members of the Politburo and give you an example. So I've got here the Politburo, some of the members of Politburo. So we have one person is the vice premier of the state council. Another is director of the general office. Another is the vice chairman of the standing committee of the NPC, vice premier of the state council, premier of the state council, chairman of the National People's Congress, party secretary of Guangdong, party secretary of Shanghai, party secretary of Tianjin, vice premier of the state council, director of the office of foreign affairs, party secretary of Xinjiang, autonomous region, party secretary of Chongqing. So what we see is that all these are people, all these people on the Politburo and in the standing committee are people who are powerful in the state. They are in charge of either very, very high level province level or very, very high level administrative or very, very high level what we might think of as constitutional offices. And sometimes they're in charge of more than one. They're overlapping. That's not fundamentally a problem most of the time in the PRC. It's not unusual. It used to happen a lot more. But again, as things become more regularized and legalistic, it becomes less frequent. So the standing committee is basically where the rubber meets the road. There is no getting around a decision of the standing committee. If this is a rule by oligarchs who are pretending to be Democrats, but then it's enmeshed in a system of a meta-state known as the Chinese Communist Party, these guys in the standing committee and of the Politburo, which is in essence a narrowing of the central committee, like, these guys are the elites of the elites of the elites. It is oligarchic in the perfect sense of the word. That doesn't mean that they're incompetent. It doesn't mean that they're stupid, and it doesn't mean that they're evil. But it does mean that it is not institutionally democratic by standards we would regard as, by standards in, that are used by liberal states today. just to give you a sense, the members of the National Congress of the CCP typically are party chiefs. They are minister level officials. They are the heads of the key military departments and posts. The minister level heads of party organizations are typically in the Congress of the CCP, and the national level heads of state sponsored civic institutions. So what this ultimately means is that we can think of this as a double whammy. On the one hand, your party membership is a vet that allows you to get it's a gateway, if you will, into state leadership. On the other hand, your state leadership is what awards you the ability to the status to be at a high level in the party. The two are inseparable in the Chinese system. Let's see. The Chinese National Congress, theoretically, its key role is in reviewing the party constitution for changes and any that might be necessary, and also in selecting members of the Central Committee, and also a couple other key positions, notably the members of the Secretariat and the General Secretary of the Chinese Communist Party. Now, the General Secretary of the Chinese Communist Party, we're going to see, is an office that correlates with the most powerful executive offices in China. So get ready. Hold on to your butt. That's coming. So that's very exciting. That's very fun. The General Secretary, very exciting, very fun. So what does this ultimately mean? Well, when we come back to the executive branch, and we look at the chief executive of China, we see that that official is theoretically one of two people. You have a split between the executive, the pinnacle of executive authority in theory. On the one hand, you have a president, which literally is the same word in Chinese as chairman, but since the 80s has been translated as president. And on the other hand, you have a premier, which is, of course, as we all know, just another word for a prime minister. The president is the head of state. The premier is the head of government. But while the president is theoretically a ceremonial position in China, at least since Deng Xiaoping passed away and left the leadership to the post-Dengist leaders, what we've seen is that the presidency has been held by someone who holds a couple other critical offices, meaning that the president in itself may not be a formally important office, but it is a signal that this is the person who is the preeminent or paramount leader, the person who has the most power, the person who displaces the most water, the person who has the most influence in every one of these various councils that we're about to talk about, whether they're in the party or whether they're in the state. And those two key positions that give the president this influence is the president is always the general secretary of the Chinese Communist Party, and the president is always the chairman of the Central Military Commission, the commander-in-chief, in other words, of China. So the president controls ultimate power over the People's Liberation Army, and the People's Armed Police, and the militias, with the position of the figurehead who is at the top of the entire process of determining who has the opportunity to hold high office and what laws can be passed at the national level, and indeed influencing the process of overturning and annulling laws passed that they don't like. So the president is very, very powerful, even though by law, the president doesn't seem like they should be powerful. The premier, on the other hand, is, again, a prime minister. They're the leader of the state council, which is, in essence, the government or the cabinet of China. They have the highest rank in the civil service. So technically, they're considered a civil servant, which is kind of an intriguing thing. They have a two-term limit. They serve concurrent terms with the NPC. But they have no command authority over the People's Liberation Army. So they're a prime minister with no command authority over the army, though they do administrate some of the military responsibilities. Most of these are like more of the bureaucratic responsibilities involved in defense. So the premier is in essence the person who leads the process of basically leads the bureaucracy and is able to do so because the leadership that has chosen the premier, particularly influenced by the president, but also influenced by the Politburo and the Standing Committee of the Politburo and the other elite groups, that president has the ability to just displace, or the premier has is basically the person who takes all of these wishes and kind of puts them into practice in the bureaucracy. Now, the president is confirmed by the MPC, but gets quote-unquote nominated by the Presidium, which is a body that is literally kind of in charge of the running the actual day-to-day affairs of the MPC. So the Presidium, they choose a president, the president is always the general secretary of the CCP, and that president then is his name or her name is sent to the NPC on a ballot where you can either confirm or deny, and there's no alternative. So you either vote for the person who's going to get it or you don't vote for the person who's going to get it, and that's kind of how it is. Theoretically, the president was on a two-term limit, and they did in practice live up to this. From 1982 to 2018, every president of China served a maximum of two terms. But Xi Jinping basically has altered that. He got the MPC to change that so that he could serve additional terms, which is one of the things that makes a lot of people wonder, is the Chinese process of institutionalization and legalization kind of slowly coming off the rails? Theoretically, the other powers of the president, they're not a lot, to promulgate laws and declare the states of emergency, the MPC or the Standing Committee tells them to. They have the power of pardoning. They are who selects and dismisses the premier, at least theoretically. Again, assume that the vetting process and all the background politics have taken place. They have the power to issue mass mobilization orders. The only power that is not theoretically under control of the MPC of the president is the power to conduct state visits. They do the equivalent of going to visit the Queen of England. So that's kind of interesting. I don't know. I find that interesting. Now, so we've talked about the premier and the president. That leaves us to talk about the state council, that cabinet. The cabinet is a big one, guys. It's got the premier, the executive vice premier, three other vice premiers, and then five people who are simply known as state counselors. Their job is to be on the state counselor. They say counselor. To be on the state council. As you would imagine, they are powerful, politically viable people. And then you have 26 ministers, the leaders of the 26 members, ministries of the People's Republic of China. Obviously, every time you change the number of ministers, that goes up. So that's 35 total members currently this year in 2020. The state council meets every 6 months, which is pretty rare for a cabinet. But it has, as you would guess, a standing committee. And that standing committee meets every week. The standing committee, no surprise who it includes, the premier, all the vice premiers, and the five state counselors. So the super kind of uber elite group of that are at the tippity top of the administrative system of the People's Republic of China. And they don't just manage the ministries of China. They also manage all the independent agencies and organs as well. So around 40 of those that aren't lumped under one or another agents or one or another ministry. So not too unusual there. Okay. All right. Where does that put us now? Well, that leads us to another of these kind of core organizations, the Central Military Commission. There's nothing simpler to understand once you've accepted that you have the state and the party as a metastate. The Central Military Commission is made up currently of the chairman, who is the commander-in-chief, who is also the president, who is also the general secretary of the Chinese Communist Party. There are two vice chairmen who are drawn from the military, and there are four other members, all high military officers, taken from the various sub-branches of the PLA, right? The Army, the Navy, and the Air Force of the PLA. I guess hypothetically, you could also have someone from the People's Armed Police. I'm not sure if there's anyone on there now from that. And I'm not sure that that number is set in stone. It might be able to be altered. But the membership of the Central Military Commission of China is exactly the same as the membership of the Central Military Commission of the Chinese Communist Party Central Committee. So that is to say, there is a perfectly analogous, with the exact same members, part of the Chinese Communist Party, upper leadership, elite leadership, that is exactly the same as the Central Military Commission. And they are in charge of, again, the People's Liberation Army, the People's Armed Police, that is the militarized police to respond to kind of basically riots and the emergence of undesired, shall we say, circumstances like Tiananmen, so that you don't actually end up having to send soldiers who are untrained in dealing with that kind of civil unrest up against a people unless you absolutely have to. And then a militia, which isn't to say, by the way, that's more about optics, I imagine. I don't know if it's just about optics. I don't know. That's another discussion for another time. But the CMC is exactly what it sounds like. It is the elite leadership that is a cabinet-style body in charge of the military of China. You can think of it as analogous to the Joint Chief of Staff, to the National Security Council in some ways in the United States. And, of course, it has that perfect analog in the meta state of the party. Then that leads us to that thing I told you was the newest major kind of chunk or branch of the Chinese system, the National Supervisory Commission, or the NSC. Now, the National Supervisory Commission exists as a state body which is intended to be anti-corruption. It is specifically, in law, listed as co-equal to the State Council and the Supreme Court, and it may be superior to the NPC and State Council, at least in practice, because its role is one of literally supervising them. Its job is to stop corruption. And one imagines corruption can be both the kind of corruption that is generally opposed in democratic liberal states, but also corruption can imply any kind of dissident behavior that might not be adequately acceptable to the state. The question of how much of that is going on versus simple, good old-fashioned trying to stop people from steal and undermine legal channels is a whole other question. Its analog is a much older body, actually, in the Chinese Communist Party, something called the CCDI. Now, the CCDI is the Central Commission for Discipline Inspection, and it's exactly what it sounds like. It is an organization inside of the Communist Party that exists for the purpose of maintaining any kind of dissident behavior, any kind of malfeasance, any kind of corruption within the party. So it is much older, and basically what's happened is an analogous body has been created in the state, which is at least theoretically exclusively focused on political, like legalistic corruption as opposed to disciplinary corruption. Though, of course, one has to imagine, given that they're analogs and that there's a high level of mutual influence, there's probably going to be some affect that goes down between them. Now, before we talk about the judiciary and the provinces, I do want to say a couple things about these other bodies we've already talked about and introduce you to some concepts. What is the concept of the Xitang Ko system? Don't worry, I'm going to spell that for you. Xitang, Xitong. Ko is Kou. And literally, the Xitang Ko system is this idea that the Chinese have. It's nothing too crazy or radical. It's very sensible. That in order to maximize the benefits from having a bureaucracy and having a legislative process, you coordinate different kinds of offices and different kinds of subcommittees and committees of bodies, both of the party and of the legislature, in order to make sure that they are coordinated along function. So offices, officers, committees are they have these kind of functional, informal lumpings together according to topic. Shitong kind of literally refers to the concept of like vertical functional agencies or groupings of bureaucracies is another translation I've seen for it. Co is sometimes, I think it's literally the character for like for mouth. It's Chinese for mouth, co. And literally it's normally translated in functional sense as referring to channels. And specifically, again, we have these channels of coordination points. Now, what's intriguing is we have these coordination points and these lumpings together by topic, but we can also understand them as vertical in the sense of from national to provincial to prefectural to local. So there is a clumping that is fairly informal, but it kind of gets rearranged every few years based upon topics and how they're understood and the best way to tackle things from the central leadership. So what is the standard one that one period will kind of change over time? As the system becomes increasingly institutionalized and legalized, Shitong Co. system seems to be becoming less important, at least at the level of the actual bureaucracy internally, and that verticalization, but it's still not unimportant from what I understand. There's also a concept called Guanxi, spelled G-U-A-N-X-I, Guanxi. Guanxi is basically a system of social networks. It is a system by which basically the idea in China that if you want to get things done, you really need to have some sort of social connection that will ease the process of engaging with someone. Because social networking allows for increased trust and therefore decreases the cost associated with trying to achieve a political outcome. This can be anything from trying to get an apartment to trying to get a high office in the elite level of the Chinese system. So frequently when we talk about Chinese politics, we do talk about the formal institutional process by which people will achieve office, but there's always the assumption that Guanxi, which is in essence the kind of particular form that patronage takes in the Chinese system, is at work in all sorts of political outcomes in practice. Now, of course, Guanxi, as you might expect, anytime you're making decisions for reasons that are not strictly institutionally defined or legalistically defined, there's going to be a tendency for them to be tainted by the sense of corruption. And to be frank, that's fair. And so Guanxi, again, are something that we see that there's actually the part of the reason why the National Supervising Commission has been established is to try and limit the impact of at least certain types of Guanxi. And to again, start this process of increased legalization, increased institutionalization, to regularize the process, increase trust, increase efficiency, decrease the cost to the average citizen and consumer, that all of these inefficiencies based on non-generative or non-regulatory political, not non-generative or non-political regulatory politics, frankly. Okay, so those are just some concepts I wanted to introduce. If we had time, we'd really, really dig into them, but we're already getting long. So let's talk about the basic judicial arrangement of China. Now, China is in essence arranged in a Supreme People's Court. And that Supreme People's Court has a subset known as local people's courts. Now, the Supreme People's Court is in essence, it is the elite appellate court of last resort, if we want to think of it in its purest form. And it is The Supreme People's Court itself, when we think of it generically, meets in Beijing, but there are also six circuit courts of the Supreme People's Court. And the Supreme People's Court, guess how many members it has? This is what's going to blow your mind. Even though it only has one president slash chief justice, the Supreme People's Court also has 340 members, 340 judges. Now, these 340 judges meet in smaller tribunals in Beijing and the other circuit courts. So the idea of this singular dominant judicial structure, which is somehow analogous to a legislature in terms of what it's supposed to be doing and its prestige, simply doesn't exist in China. Now, 340 is still not a ton, but there's no question that the intent is for this to be more along the lines of an elite bureaucratic kind of position. The local people's courts can then be subdivided. They're the courts of first instance and then have some appellate function into high people's courts, intermediate people's courts, and basic people's courts. And they're just what it sounds like. High people's courts are the people's courts that are either courts of first instance in the province, or they hear appeals from lower courts. Intermediate people's courts are high people are the appeals people courts at the prefectorial level, or they are the appeals court for the basic people's courts. And the basic people's courts, not an appeals court ever. They are where the vast majority of court action takes place, and they are basically at every level and every possible organization you can imagine, administrative unit you can imagine below the prefecture level. There are also courts of special jurisdiction in the People's Republic of China, not surprising at all. So the least surprising is we have a military court system, but we also have a railway court system, a maritime court system, an intellectual property court system, a financial court system, and what is maybe the most interesting and kind of says, oh, look, we've got an authoritarian state on our hands, an internet court system. So that's kind of intriguing. We have a civil law tradition in China. I think I mentioned that already, but it's worth saying again. Civil law tradition, which means that basically we have no defensive system. It's not an adversarial system like in the United States. This means that judges are appointed by the various people's congresses to serve maximum of 2 5-year terms, and they exist as inquisitors along with the members of the procurate. So the procurate are the prosecutors. The judges are inquisitors. They are interrogating and asking questions of the people involved in the case in question. Courts typically, these inquisitorial courts are typically, they're overseen by 1 to 3 judges, depending on how serious the question is. And then these judges are also joined by these other people called assessors. Assessors are also elected, but they're elected specifically for their experience, typically one assumes in politics or in law. And these assessors basically engage in the process of they're professionals who are somewhat analogous to a jury, but they're more professionalized. We don't really have an analogous institution in the United States. China, it should also be said, borrowing from the Japanese and Korean experience, puts heavy emphasis on mediation and arbitration. Binding mediation and arbitration, of course, cost a lot less than court cases and are a great way to actually get stuff done in short order. They're one of those things that are, if you were critical of the United States legislative system, or not legislative, judicial system, probably one of the things you might say is we maybe should use at least somewhat more mediation because it is so much faster and less expensive. But there you are. The Supreme People's Procurate, on the other hand, is, again, this very high-level body, which basically is the whole management of the system of prosecutors, of state prosecutors. And, again, each level's procurators are basically approved and ratified by the congresses at their level. So local level, prefecture level, province level, etc. So, okay, easy peasy. That's judicial system. We don't need to get into it too much. It's analogous to all the other civil systems. The key thing to bear in mind is it is deeply corrupt in a lot of ways. It's very problematic. And also, China has a nasty habit of just locking people up without trials, or they go to trial and the things are, shall we say, problematic, which one would assume in a country where you have deeply flawed freedom of speech, freedom of, like, a guarantee of a public trial isn't there, etc. So, nothing too surprising there. Then we have basically the question of how is China vertically administered? Now, remember, China's an unitary state. And as a unitary state, that means subnational political units do not have sovereignty in and of themselves. They exist for administrative purposes, even if they're allowed some degree of self-management in the form of their own governments. Now, in a non-democratic state, any self-governance is probably suspect, to say the very least. So, in the Chinese system, what we have is we have five fundamental divisions. A provincial level, a prefectural level, a county level, a township level, and a village level. Now, these can each be subdivided. Those are levels, so everything within that level is regarded of as having the same kind of political authority and status. Normally, it means they are larger. The higher up you go, the larger the population is really the key distinguisher. So the provincial level is the area that's frankly the most important for us. That has four different fundamental types of subdivisions. Five of the provincial level bodies are autonomous regions. That is to say, they're areas that are principally denoted as they're supposed to be, in theory, though not necessarily in practice, autonomous in order to be areas governed by the very large minority populations, ethno-national minority populations. There's four of those, not five, I'm sorry. And these are Xinjiang, or Uyghurstan, as we sometimes call it in the United States, Tibet, Guangxi, and Nei Mongol, or Inner Mongolia. There are also 23 provinces in China, four municipalities that are directly administered by the central government, and these municipalities are Tianjin, which is where I actually lived for the better part of a summer once, Beijing, of course, the capital of China, Shanghai, which is, of course, one of the great centers of human population on Earth, bigger than most of the states of the United States, and it's a city in terms of population. And then, of course, Chongqing, which is arguably the fastest growing part of China, certainly the fastest growing part away from the coastal areas. And that's where the Three Gorges Dam is. We also have two special administrative regions. The special administrative regions are interesting. They are areas that were administered by Western nations as colonies until the 1990s. Specifically, Macau, which was ruled by Portugal, and Hong Kong, which was ruled by Britain. And Hong Kong, I believe, became... it was 1997 Hong Kong joined China, and Macau was, I believe, 1999. And they entered Chinese administration again under a system that is generically kind of known as the one country, two system model, which means they continue to have democratic institutions and self-rule over a huge portion of their policy. However, they are definitively under the Chinese system and under Chinese sovereignty. And of course, as you can imagine, this is the source of ongoing controversy and conflict in both of those cities, particularly in Hong Kong. The prefectural level has four different fundamental types of subdivisions as well. There are seven prefectures, 30 autonomous prefectures, or is it 30? Yeah, 30. There are 294 prefecture-level cities. Now, these are not necessarily small cities. These are millions and millions of people. And then there are leagues. There are three leagues, and they are informally... They're in Mongol territory, so they're a holdover from the old republic and imperial days. The counties, there are 2,852 county level administrative units in China. Of these, 1,408 are counties. 1,117 of them are autonomous counties. So we have four autonomous regions, 30 autonomous prefectures, 117 autonomous counties, and then we have 360 or so other county-level kinds of bodies. Now, there are a profusion of other types of these subunits, the townships. There's over 40,000 township-level units. There's a bunch of different kinds, including some autonomous township-level bodies. And there are around 700,000 village-level administrative units. That's a lot. We're not going to, and then, of course, as you imagine, there's quite a bit of variation amongst them. We're not going to get into those too much. But at each of these levels, there is at least the sense that the Chinese are attempting to have a system of parallel leadership between a state institution, a state kind of Congress or council, and then a Communist Party council or Congress. Then these are running parallel to each other and are engaged in this kind of ongoing discourse for selecting who can have office, how are rules and policies developed, and so forth. And of course, they engage in this in a vertical discourse as well, from level to level. So the Chinese system is really interesting in that sense. It is not by any means what we would call democratic, but it's also, it would be flawed to say that the Chinese system is not got millions and millions of people who are engaged in a rather deep process of discourse in the generation of policy. So it's not democratic. It is dominated by a powerful autocracy at the top. It's, I think, very fair to call it a partyocracy or oligarchy, but it is also kind of a very weird and unique system that is becoming more regularized. And if China continues to experiment with village-level democracy and then possibly takes it up a level of analysis, it's tough to say if China will become more politically liberal or not in the future. I'm skeptical of that, but I'm hopeful as well. Well, everybody, this has been a nice hour and a half almost lecture, and I'm tired, and I'm sure you're tired of listening. So if you have any questions, please remember to call me, email me, write me. We'll set up a meeting. We'll talk about anything you need to. Stay healthy, stay safe, keep yourself mentally healthy, and I hope you're all doing very well. And I will talk to you as soon as I can. Take care.